Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley. I'm here with my co-hosts, Tom Coffey and Scott Hoag. And today we're going to talk about IPv6 only and what that really means, because no one actually talks about that. And we're going to be joined by Veronica McCullough, who's with Microsoft, to talk about her work around IPv6 only, but also to hear all the wonderful work she's been doing as a chair of the UK IPv6 Council. She was a founder of that organization. So Veronica, welcome to the IPv6 Buzz. We want to learn a little bit about you and your background and, you know, why IPv6 is of interest. So take it away.
Good morning, Ed, Tom and Scott. It's really nice to be here with you. So thank you for inviting me to come along. In 2016, I got the opportunity to move from pre-sales organization in Cisco to internal IT organization in Microsoft, where I lead the IPv6 efforts on behalf of Network Infrastructure Services team. And I tell you what, the team is pretty big. Not in terms of people, but what it manages. And we basically support over 700 locations globally. This is for corporate network. This is not Azure, because people often mistake. And when I say I work for Microsoft IT, they think that I also am responsible for IPv6 and Azure. That's not the case. They are my partner, and we work very closely together, because obviously internally in Microsoft, we also leverage Azure and all the cloud services there. And it's been actually quite an interesting ride, because when I joined the team, they already have started with IPv6 in that sense. They've enabled it on the corporate network for the employees on wireless and wired. But the other parts of network, the other networks they've got, they are still V4. So, and already at that point, they knew that they have to go in the V6 only direction, simply because we are running out of RFC 1918 space, and it's actually starting to impact our internal business. So that's where I am, and I'm trying to push this forward with the help of people in our organization in Microsoft.
Awesome. Like many large enterprises who've been, you know, running out of private IPv4 address space, it's interesting. Yeah, I would imagine there's a massive number of devices in the Microsoft network, and you're constrained. So as enterprises expand their networks into cloud or IoT or through acquisitions, exactly, they find it even more restrictive. So, I mean, the massive number of devices, Microsoft's, you know, getting involved in Internet of Things technologies. How is Internet of Things adding to the address space, or what is Microsoft doing with IoT and IPv6?
That's eating the address space like a hungry dog. That's all I can tell you, because we've got currently an initiative, a strategic initiative, which is called network segmentation. And basically the whole idea, it's not just from the address space perspective, but also from security perspective, is like, up to this point, all these IoT devices, they basically live on the corpnet. So anybody can plug them in. Like, actually, wireless corpnet is much more secure, and these devices are often not allowed to connect to the wireless corpnet. But on the wired corpnet, people can plug in lots of things, and without us knowing, obviously. So there is some other effort where we are working on deploying a type of network admission control solution for this, you know. So we are starting to be more restrictive. However, these IoT devices, as you say, they live on our corpnet, and they use this address space. So as part of the network segmentation effort, we are actually trying to create a separate network for them. Obviously, like the physical network itself, it's going to go over the same devices. But if you imagine the simplest separation by creating separate VRF for them on the network. But eventually, this needs to be IPv6 enabled, which it isn't at the moment. Well, on corpnet it is, obviously, like that's dual stack. But for the separate network that we are building for these IoT devices, that also will be dual stack enabled. And our big challenges there are, for example, and like the ultimate goal, again, is going to be V6 only. But I would say, for example, the end user segments, like the wireless corpnet, it's much more predictable from what connects to it than the wired segment. And doesn't matter what is the corpnet or the IoT segment, simply because these devices, there's like millions of them, right? You've got a limited number of the end user devices that they can bring, laptops and smartphones and stuff like that. But the IoT is like, there are like new things every day. And they, for example, very much like to use Android operating system. And there we've got the challenge of Android not supporting the ACPv6, right? So we have to have support in the network for RDNSS, which propagates the DNS information to these Android devices, right, on V6. But luckily, we've got that. We are actually getting through it. Our network infrastructure is capable, and we've certified a gold code, which has this feature included, right? So yeah, the IoT is a very interesting area, and I say we often the manufacturers of IoT devices, they go for whatever is available. Android operating system is used very much, and we need to make sure that the network is capable of supporting that.
Veronica, did you inherit an address plan when you came to Microsoft, or is that something that you've been able to work on and to refine since you've been on board?
Well, I inherited, for sure. That was already there. There were a couple of engineers who were before me, and an architect as well. So first address plan was created in 2006 or something like that. And then it was adjusted and adapted and changed a little bit in 2015. And I just wrote the last revision early this summer, because we basically had to carve out some space for our internet-only sites, because Microsoft is going in the direction as well that there will be sites which for end users will not offer corporate connectivity, but only internet connectivity. That kind of goes hand in hand with our cloud strategy. So I can talk more about this, but to your question regarding addressing plan, that I already inherited it.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's been flexible enough for you to work within the framework that you sort of inherited. And going forward, do you feel that that's going to continue to be the case, or will there be additional revisions?
Yeah, definitely. There will be always a very heated debate. I tell you what, that's quite an interesting experience to be part of the discussion. But basically, what I said as a rule is that the addressing plan and the way we change it should not really tie us to anything that could block us in the future. You know, for example, like embedding some information or tying some information in the addressing plan to a type of service provider that we connect to. Because that will change. Right now, we might have a few global service providers that connect our corpnet. But in the future, especially with the internet-only or internet-first initiative, there will be any service provider that can connect us to the internet, you know, in those small locations. So it has to be pretty flexible, and we must not create any technical debt. Mm-hmm. That's basically the rule that I put there. There are some people who don't like it, but that's the way we are going. And yeah, many iterations, and I'm sure there will be even when I'm not there.
Well, I think for the audience, really quickly, in terms of those that are listening, one of the reasons Tom and Veronica are having this conversation is, well, Tom obviously wrote his book on IPv6 address planning, but Veronica is, I proctored her, one of your IPv6 address planning workshops in the UK, running around and helping folks in terms of talking through the address plan, and there's actually some funny stories around Veronica and Tom that maybe we could dive into in regards to speaking in the UK, because Tom, I think you were sick and flying over to actually present over there, right?
Yeah, in my defense, it was jet lag and too much cough medicine and general psychosis that comes from international travel and not delivering my best presentation and not doing my research ahead of time to find out all of that great work that Veronica was talking about earlier with the UK Council and really that moment when the service providers in the UK decided that they're going to get serious about IPv6. I missed that memo, and so here I am in front of the UK NOF audience, and I'm spouting off about, well, you know, I don't, and I, it was just like an offhand comment. In my recollection, it was an offhand comment about I'll come back in another year and maybe V6 will be further along or something along those lines. But, not necessarily a happy message about IPv6, and definitely not not accommodating all of the great work that had been done in the last, you know, year, and certainly in the last few months with that announcement. So that's where things got interesting for me when I got off, when I got off the stage.
Yeah, that was very funny because I was in the room and also some other people from the council, and especially like guys from Sky, who is the second largest ISP in the UK, and they made an announcement a few months before that they were getting serious about V6, you know, and from internal trials they were moving to custom trials and they were about to enable V6. In fairness, it was early 2015, and Tom, I completely understand that you could have missed the announcement of UK IPv6 Council starting the work. But I, at that point, I was very, very upset. So I remember running after you after your presentation, and then in the hall we had quite. I basically expressed my dissatisfaction with your comment because all I was trying to do in the UK was just to remove that negative perception of IPv6 deployments, and that they were, that nothing was really happening. I was like, oh my God, like, what is this guy even talking about? But yeah. Luckily, Tom and Ed are friends, and Ed and me were friends as well. So it helped to reconciliate. And then we gave a really good talk in Glasgow, and I think that was in 2016.
Yeah, that's right.
At UKNOF. And that had really good feedback from the attendees. So I think it was great.
Yeah, it all worked out in the end. It turned out we were on the same team after all, which I don't think was obvious when I made my my offhand comment. And my presentation was about DHCP V6 operational challenges, which I don't know what I was thinking. You go in front of essentially an ISP audience and start talking about DHCP V6, and you know, people are like putting their heads on the table, you know, just going to sleep. No, it wasn't that bad, but you know, I feel like probably part of it was just not feeling like I was really connecting with the audience for my presentation material, and flailing about trying to make comments to engage the audience, one of which was, oh yeah, IPv6 in the UK, when will it happen? It turns out in the end it was all good. But I have to say, just in regards to that exercise that you guys talked about doing with, you know, giving a tectorial and having the folks that are attending get a chance to get their hands dirty with getting an allocation and carving it up, even if they know it's just practice. I mean, there's a huge psychological barrier there related to address planning. I'm sure Veronica, you could speak to this as well. It's just that, you know, that terror that people have with, you know, all of the V4 planning they've done in the past and how careful they've had to be with host addressing. And then all of a sudden they've got this ocean of space and they don't know what to do with it. And even just doing that on paper one time is like a huge step forward in getting over that psychological barrier of having the space and using it the right way. So kudos to you guys kudos to you, Veronica, for really helping make that happen, you know, in a safe space, so to speak. And then, you know, those folks can go back and tackle their own address plans with a lot more confidence.
Yeah, I would say with IPv6, I'm probably like with anything really, the normal human reaction is if we don't understand something, we don't know it well enough, we are afraid of it. And I am speaking even for myself, right? I avoid certain things simply because I didn't spend enough time, you know, to get comfortable, you know, get the knowledge to a certain level. And I think if people feel that there is somebody who can support them and hold their hand, while they are taking the first steps, that it actually has a huge benefit, you know, to removing that fear. That's true in life in general, but for IPv6, that's, I think, why the IPv6 Council so is doing quite well, and we are definitely being referred to as an authority here in the UK. Even without me trying, right, to tell somebody, and we are not trying to be any authority. As I said, we are just a group of people that come together and talk about technology. But definitely.
Yeah, this, Veronica.
This essential. Yeah.
Veronica, you mentioned British Sky Broadcasting, and that's one of the organizations that I often cite as a real success story. I mean, if you go to the World IPv6 Launch Measurement site and look at their ASN and their IPv6 adoption statistics, it grew tremendously in early 2016. In just a few months, it went from like 10% to 70%. And so it shows how, you know, a small dedicated group of folks can make a huge impact in a region in terms of IPv6 adoption, and how that tipping point effect can take place, where UV6 enable networks, and the endpoints are already V6 enabled, or the subscribers are already V6 ready, and then the traffic just flows to using IPv6. Yeah. And so that's an example of one of those service providers who have made tremendous success in a very short period of time. Some people think, oh, IPv6 is going to take a really long time. No, if you are dedicated and have a plan, you can execute rapidly.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so, absolutely correct.
So then, and in that context, what does it look like then to get to, in your opinion, Veronica, what does it look like to get to IPv6 only based on where we're at today? Because I'm not sure the folks that are listening to the podcast, you know, it's when you're sitting amongst a group of folks that are focused on IPv6, it's not all that surprising to hear IPv6 only discussed. But for the folks who are sort of just now getting the memo that's like, well, we need to move to IPv6 and the best and easiest transition technology to get us there is going to be dual stack and relax, because you're always going to have your IPv4 network, you know, and V6 essentially an overlay with that, with dual stack. And then, you know, then suddenly they read something about IPv6 only around the corner. And it's like, well, oh goodness, what are we going to have to do to make that happen? And so just that, there's that larger perspective from those folks' view, but within our community, mm-hmm. I think we can provide that sort of vision of what that looks like. And the folks that are listening that are in enterprise that are, you know, definitely sort of stuck with dual stack mindset, you know, sort of have a vision of what it's going to look like to get to that IPv6 only future.
So I would say first V6 only or just IPv6 in dual stack. The first thing is you need to have a business reason. And this is what I hear constantly, and people come and ask, so what are the business drivers for IPv6? And I'm telling them, like, guys, you know your organization, you know how you function on the internet. You know that the internet is moving to V6. It might have slowed down recently a little bit, but based on the Google stats, we are at about like 24%. I was checking it earlier today. Different countries are further down the road, like Belgium, US, you know, Germany. In UK, we peaked at 23%, so that's pretty decent. And basically, I would just say people need to realize that they have got the drivers internal, which could be, for example, the V4 address depletion, like we've got, but it's not just us, like many large enterprises have it in general, and they are getting through this pain of multiple layers of NAT in the network and in the data centers. But also the world around us is changing, and people kind of tend to forget about it, that with today, the mobile workforce of today, basically, you don't have the network that your users used to connect to your services. You don't have that network under your control. And the reason why I say it, and that's why it's essential to enable all the end user services that are kind of accessed over the internet, that all needs to be enabled with IPv6, because IPv4 is getting worse in its quality. And the reason why I say that, there are multiple large ISPs. The names are well known: Comcast, Charter Communications, Free in France, Reliance Jio in India. There'll be one soon in the UK. I can't talk about it yet. But mm-hmm. basically, all these folks are moving to IPv4 as a service, which means that V4 traffic on their networks is going to be treated as a second-class citizen. And I, as an enterprise service provider to my employees, to our customers' employees, I don't have those network under control at all. So this is I would say that is a big incentive and like reason why people need to get on with IPv6 in general, if it is even that intermediate step of dual stack, because once people go to dual stack and they kind of get used to it and kind of realize, like, why are we really running two protocols in the network, and dual stack really doesn't help us with V4 depletion, and this could have impact on our internal business, you know, on the different product groups. When they are moving to virtualization, to cloud, they are eating V4 space as French croissants for breakfast, and basically dual stack doesn't help us there, right? So people then eventually, and I've seen it over the years, right? People start with dual stack and then they really start to think about V6 only, but dual stack helps them to build the confidence. And I would say that's also true in our case. And for us, as I said, the business driver is truly, truly V4 depletion. And if we needed to satisfy today's requirements of our internal product groups for V4, we would have to go in the market and spend millions of dollars on acquiring IPv4 space. And we don't want to do it. First of all, it's wasted money. We can spend it on something else. Second of all, IPv4 address space quality, what is available in the market, is getting worse, because what is currently available in the market, the large address space, from what I've heard, has bad reputation. So if you go and acquire those spaces, it's huge administrative work to actually clean that space, to make sure that it doesn't get rejected, doesn't get blocked on the internet, you know, all the registries that actually track the reputation of IPv4, that basically realize, like, this is not a bad IP space that came from a bad country or was abused by some criminal group. Right. Basically, that is a huge effort. So it actually makes V4 even less attractive. And then we also don't want to route something what is deemed as a public IPv4 space. We don't want to route it inside our network. So the only answer really is V6 only.
Wow. So
I don't know. Does it make sense? You know?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. I think it's fascinating for folks to hear, sort of, like, you know, because for many people on the podcast, they probably don't know anything about, like, you know, public reputation for IPv4 and the fact that there are these organizations out there that basically rate, you know, they rate how good a quality of dependability that V4 address is actually legitimate and passing real traffic that you should take from a business perspective. And that might be something new that many people haven't heard of.
I would give you a story which I heard recently from, I'm sure, our joint friend Sander Stefan from the Netherlands, who was telling me that he had a friend, and this person applied for US visa, and he was rejected, and he didn't understand why. So he kind of was looking into it, and then he eventually found out that he was rejected based on the fact that the IPv4 address from which he applied was registered somewhere in Libya, even though he was applying in his provider is Vodafone. So it looks like this service provider acquired that IPv4 space, but basically the reputation of that space in the US customs, whatever, you know, that organization is, sorry guys, I don't know the name. Basically, they were the database that they are using. They basically said, you came from bad space, so you must have been somewhere there, so we don't want you here. And it actually is, and only just because this guy is a techie, he found out why. But you can imagine, like, an ordinary citizen who has got no idea about the IPv4 internet and what is happening right now, they can be impacted and be completely innocent people. Or, you know, there were talks about the CGN and how basically one bad guy sitting together with you on the same network segment that is translated to particular V4 address, you can also be impacted by what the other guy is doing, right? So, yeah, it's something that people don't often think about it, or even how the traffic is treated on the internet, the V4 traffic, that is going to be getting worse from what I hear from different ISPs. And that's why we need to deploy V6, because that is not going to be impacted.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I've heard you talk about before, Veronica, is IPv6 enabling, you know, guest wireless networks, and how you may choose to do that because maybe it's a well-known or well-confined area of your topology. You don't have to plumb in IPv6 across your corporate backbone or to the data center. It's a project you can take on, kind of like IPv6 enabling your internet perimeter. And that's often the recommendation we give to universities, you know, get IPv6 into the hands of people who will use it, the students, you know, the faculty, the staff, the guests on the university campus. So how is that going? Or describe how you've done that a little bit.
Thanks, Scott, for asking. So I gave this talk at the North American IPv6 Summit last year, right? Was it 2017?
Mm-hmm. Yes, at LinkedIn.
I'm trying to, remember. So 2 weeks later, I had to stop all that work. And the reason was very simple, because week after that summit, there was a Facebook at Scale conference. And Paul Sapp, he is a big promoter of IPv6, as we all know. Mm-hmm. And so the guest network that was offered at the conference is IPv6 only. And Paul says at the conference that basically probably majority of people, their VPN clients will not work. And my colleague was at that conference, and our VPN didn't work. The simple reason was that VPN clients in general, unless they have got certain workarounds deployed or IPv6 enabled on the VPN gateways, they are not able to connect through NAT64. And obviously, this is what we were planning for the guest network. And we were planning to offer IPv6 only with NAT64 because still 76% of the internet is IPv4 only. So we really can't cut people off. But unfortunately, we realized that we would impact every visitor who will try to connect their VPN back to the corporate. And if their their VPN gateways were not IPv6 enabled, then they would not be able to connect. So from that reason, we actually had to stop that project, and we had to kind of regroup and focus on V6 only corpnet, which we are currently working on.
Yeah, that's often recommendation I give to large enterprises who have a VPN for their employees or remote workers or what have you, whether it's IPsec or SSL VPN. I often encourage them to dual stack that so that it could receive connections from either, because oftentimes, you know, if you have, let's say, branch offices or stores that are retail locations that are VPNing back to a corporate headquarters, well, those stores are turned up with the same DSL cable modems that we all use as subscribers, and they may not get a static V4 address that's non-changing for the purposes of building a IPsec tunnel. So I often encourage them, well, you will get a global IPv6 address. So use that global non-changing V6 address that's allocated to your subscriber, now your store or your remote office. Use V6 as your tunnel transport, you know, or have the choice to do either if you're in a situation where you're working in a location, a geography where the service providers don't offer, you know, static V4 addresses. So I often encourage, employers to do both, and it puts you in an advantageous position. Same thing why you want to make your DNS servers dual protocol. Those things that are connected to the internet that you want to have broad internet connectivity to, make them dual so you can avoid situations like that.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So from the reason we have since deployed a new solution for our VPN. And right now the situation for us is that the VPN is dual stacked inside the tunnel, but we are waiting for our load balancing platform to basically be able to advertise both V4 and V6, because obviously when the client tries to connect, it does a DNS lookup for the VPN gateways, right? And that's sitting behind the load balancing platform. So while the VPN gateway obviously supports tunnel termination on both V4 and V6, we are still kind of like waiting for that. But that's definitely a committed plan, something that is happening as soon as we resolve that last final bit. So yeah, and I would say that inside the tunnel, then the enterprises obviously have option of doing either V4 only, or they could do also dual stack, or maybe they could try to push it for further with IPv6 only. And that's what we've tried. Unfortunately, only when we attempted to test that, we found out that our new vendor, they were not supporting such a functionality on V6 only inside the tunnel. And we would like to get to that as well, so we remove any dependency on IPv4 for remote users, inside the tunnel, right? So that also means we can reclaim that V4 space. So basically, we are looking at everything where we can go and take V4 away and just put it back to the piggy bank that can be used for product groups. But we are telling everybody you have to do dual stack at least, right?
Yeah, that's a dirty little secret of corporate VPNs. They think they've deployed an IPv4 VPN and they enforce no split tunneling. So they think all the traffic's going to come back through the corporate and then go through the perimeter of the corporate headquarters, internet egress point, and they can enforce security policies. Well, that no split tunneling rule only works on the V4 traffic. If the end user is at a coffee shop, hotel, remote location, or at home where they have V6, the V6 traffic is going to go direct to the internet and not through the VPN tunnel. So if you're an enterprise and you want to enforce no split tunneling, turn up your VPN where it has V4 and V6 and does no split tunneling for V4 and V6. And then you could be in control of the, you know, end user's traffic that's using the VPN. But to not turn up one protocol is ignoring what's really happening.
Stop exactly giving away all our secrets, Scott. Jeez.
VPN tunnel breakout.
Too funny. Well, I'm Veronica. I mean, given the sort of journey that you've gone through with, especially around the wireless stuff for Microsoft and everything, and there's fits and stops, and this is sort of the organic nature of where V6 is at today on the mm-hmm. adoption cycle. And you've had the opportunity to sort of get out there and present and talk to people. And is there any sort of insights you wanted to be sort of wrap up around, like, because it's you know, for all of us, it's been a long slog. It's a journey. it's not an overnight thing. Is there any guidance you wanted to give, you know, the audience around, like, hey, you know, these are the starting points. This is, you know, this is the stuff that's really important. Any rules of thumb, anything that you wanted to share that, you know, sort of around that topic?
It's a perseverance game. It is, right? No matter how much we want that we could just go and turn it on, it just takes time because, for example, the networking is getting easier, right? Like the networking vendors, they are in a pretty good shape right now when it comes to V6 support in general. But then you've got the questions around the applications, you know, that's always the big question. So I would say, What I'm doing currently for V6 only, and I'm looking at all the networks that we manage, network infrastructure services in Microsoft, and also I'm looking at all the different partners and customers internally that are leveraging this network, and I have to engage with them and have this conversation. So I would say, like, a starting point is to really go have the conversation, explain what the drivers are, because often people, even today, right, and I'm sure you come across this in your daily practice, that people don't see a reason why we need to do IPv6. They know it's kind of out there, it's been out there for a really long time. But if you tell them, like, look, this is really impacting us internally, and if you then come to us in 6 months and tell us you want V4, we tell you we don't have anything. We don't have anything to give you, so you have to do V6. And people don't like to hear that. So I think also I'm looking at all the networks, all the customers and partners, and it's about early engagement. Because I know, for example, in Microsoft, this is going to be a huge effort. And it is already, right? We've been kind of like planning and working on this probably, where are we, August? Probably now, I would say, almost 10 months. And right now, we have got the V6 only corporate pilot, which is our wireless network. It's a separate SSID where people, they connect to it, opt in. We still, obviously, in those sites where we've got it, we maintain the dual stack corporate wireless so people can fall back on it in case, you know, they come across applications that don't work on V6 only and through NAT64. So obviously, that's what we've got deployed there. We can't internally, we still have got X number of applications that are not V6 enabled. Plus, we've got dependency on Azure Express Route. I know this is a well-known thing that Express Route at this very moment doesn't support V6, but I can tell you this is coming in the very foreseeable future. So we are engaging with our peers internally who are working on that, who run Azure Express Route for us and all the cloud deployment. So it's all about having these conversations really well in advance and identifying things that at that point in time, when we are doing this recon, we know this is something where we are going to have issues, right? And so I would say it's a humongous task. So it can be depressing because there's so much to do and there are not enough people to do the work. And IPv6 lives everywhere and touches everybody. And the people who are touched by it, they don't even know about it. So it's kind of like, as I said, perseverance, something that every person needs to equip themselves with, and then also do this kind of like housekeeping exercise, really look at where IPv6 needs to be. And I would say our motto is really enable IPv6 everywhere and IPv6 only everywhere we can,
right,
before we get to a point where it's going to be IPv6 only everywhere we must. because that's it's just gonna grow. But there will be still some areas, even in many years, which probably will be dual stack, simply because Microsoft has customers that will run in V4 environment for many years, and they the products need to work in that environment. So we just can't really remove it. But I would say early engagement. You know, mapping out your territory. Looking at it and partner with everybody you can, you know, go and get other people excited about it, you know, because one small group of people can't do it all. It's very simple, right?
Yeah, Scott has this whole phrase about, you know, about it's, you know, it's a broccoli protocol and you got to get your kids early on eating their vegetables. So.
Yeah, I like that one. That's very nice.
It's like flossing your teeth, anything, you know, it's good for you, but, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and we're the, and we're the weirdos that like broccoli for some reason. So.
well, with that, you know, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your tremendous amount of experience. And also, I wanted to thank you for like the crazy amount of community work that you've done over the years of giving back, sharing knowledge. I mean, it's been fantastic. And just on a personal level, you know, the friendship over the years for coming out and doing that just in the V6 community space. I know that's true for Tom and Scott too.
Absolutely.
So it's very, very cool. But unlike V6, we're running out of space for the podcast. So Veronica, I wanted to wrap up with sort of allowing the audience to sort of, you know, how can they reach out and talk to you on the internet? Is there blogs? Is there public appearances, books, Twitter handles, anything else that you might want to share or talk about?
Well, you can follow the UK Apivisis Council website. If you are in the European region, you can come along to our events. We usually organize them in London, and the website is www.ipv6.org.uk. It's very simple. I think I've got a Twitter account, but I don't use it. I know there will be a blog published soon at the APNIC blog, because Robbie from APNIC, he approached me after my UKNOF talk that I gave in January this year in London, and he asked if I could write one about our efforts. So there'll be a blog about our, like, the main points of our V6 only efforts, what we've done in the last 12 months. Yeah, that's about it.
Well, you're busy, so that's totally cool. I get it. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for listening to the IPv6 Buzz podcast. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Scott Hoag. Scott, where can we follow you on the internet?
Yeah, I'm at Scott Hoag on Twitter, and I write for the Infoblox IPv6 Center of Excellence, as Ed and Tom do, and I write for Network World.
All right, Tom, where can folks find you on the internet?
Well, my Twitter handle is at IPv6Tom, strangely enough. And also, if you're interested in learning more about address planning, I wrote a whole book on it, O'Reilly Media IPv6 Address Planning. And I also publish at the Infoblox IPv6 Center of Excellence blog.
Cool. Well, and for me, you can find me at Hugh Horley on Twitter. More important, you can find us on the Packet Pusher podcast. We're now at packetpushers.net/series/IPv6buzz. So we're like totally official now, which is awesome. So, and there's tons of other great content up on Packet Pushers. So please make sure you go check it out. You can get the full feed if you want that, or the other ones that's there. So until next time, we'll see you on the internet, the IPv6 internet.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.